Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We have, on a number of occasions on this radio program, declared inflation dead.
Look who knows so much, huh? Well, it just so happens that your friend here is only mostly dead. There's a big difference between mostly dead and all dead.
With apologies to Miracle Max and the Princess Bride from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 22nd of July. And what you need to know about that cut from The Princess Bride, which is a great movie, by the way, is that it continues.
Mostly dead. He's slightly alive.
Which gets us, yes, indirectly, I know, but it does get us to our top story. The government's measure of inflation, the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, for June came out this morning. Prices did indeed inch up. The aforementioned slightly alive, emphasis on the inch. Overall, the CPI was up 0.3% last month. You take out volatile stuff like food and energy, as the Federal Reserve likes to do, and prices rose just a tenth of 1%. So with all that, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark gets us going.
Even if inflation is still pretty modest right now, it doesn't always feel like it. John Canelli is an economist at the brokerage firm LPL Financial.
Most of us drive past a gas station every day. Most of us go to the grocery store and have to buy staples. On the stuff that we see every day, those prices tend to be rising at a faster rate than the rest of the price deck.
But Canelli says the stuff we don't buy on a regular basis, like flat-screen TVs and cars, prices for those things have actually fallen slightly in the last month. When you add all those trends up, inflation is still sluggish. But so is something else. Workers' wages. They're just barely keeping pace with inflation, meaning for the time being, businesses need to keep prices pretty low.
Really hard to get the price increases at the taco stand or at the burger joint or anywhere else to stick if people don't have enough money or enough wages to pay those price increases.
With wages and prices at a sort of deadlock right now, the boogeyman of runaway inflation that we saw in the 70s just isn't a threat for the time being, according to Mark Cooperberg, an economist at Swarthmore College.
People need to chillax a little bit about it, chill out, not worry so much about it. And in fact, because it's low, there's really no reason to worry.
So while crazy inflation may not be a worry, we don't want to head toward deflation either. Sarah Watthouse is an economist at Wells Fargo Securities.
We don't want to see prices going down so low that nobody goes out buying anything because they assume that prices will be cheaper tomorrow.
It's that sweet spot we're trying to hang on to, where the economy's not too hot, but not too cold. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Apple posted second quarter profits after the bell this afternoon, $37.4 billion in revenues the past 3 months. Not quite a license to print money and a hair less than analysts had been guessing, but still a boatload of cash, am I right? Microsoft has $80 billion in the bank. The drug conglomerate Pfizer has close to $50 billion. So what are big companies like these doing, or more accurately, not doing with all that money? Dan Bobkoff has that story.
On this episode of Hoarders, Corporate America.
I think most CFOs would not admit they have hoarded too much cash.
Still, Duke finance professor John Graham says companies have about 50% more cash on their balance sheets than 10 to 15 years ago. Is it time for an intervention?
I think, you know, they did just live through a financial crisis. So part of that is they think being prudent that you want to hold your cash so in case it becomes difficult to borrow down the road.
Non-financial companies had $1.6 trillion in cash at the end of last year, according to Moody's, where Richard Lane is the senior vice president.
A lot of the money is effectively just sitting there, and where it's sitting increasingly is offshore.
It's locked up overseas, mostly to avoid U.S. taxes.
I don't need Apple to save money. My local bank or credit union will handle it for me just fine.
David K. Johnston teaches at Syracuse University's College of Law. He says corporate hoarding is bad for the economy.
What you're not seeing them do with this cash is invest in new factories and research operations that would create jobs and fundamentally grow the business.
There are signs companies are loosening up a little. Apple just made its biggest ever acquisition, spending $3 billion to acquire headphone maker Beats. And activists are increasingly pressuring companies to give more of their profits back to investors. In a recent survey of CFOs, about half say they're going to spend more on their businesses soon, but the other half, they're not budging. in New York. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders had fun storming the castle. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There aren't a whole lot of domestic policy issues that are higher profile than education right now, both K-12 and higher education. We are spending some time this week talking to people who deal day in and day out with some of the big issues in this country, how they think about them, and what the future might hold. Today, Drew Faust, the president of Harvard University, and her take on the state of higher education in this country. Dr. Faust, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
How much time do you spend thinking about your job as the president of Harvard, you know, in quotations and italics, as it relates to the rest of higher education in this country? I mean, people look to you, they look to your institution for leadership. You know, does that keep you up at night?
Nothing keeps me up
at night.
All right,
well, good to know you're a sound sleeper.
I sleep very well. But I think Harvard does have and has had a leadership role in higher education, and I hope that there are certain principles and standards that we can articulate in a way that has an impact on those who hear them because of what we have long represented and what we do for students and faculty today. I do recognize that in many ways we are very blessed with a large endowment and the ability to attract so many applicants so that we have some distinct advantages. And I wouldn't want to generalize beyond Harvard too much. But the fundamental value of learning, the value of challenging ourselves in the realm of research and relating our research and teaching, I think all of these are important principles that I endeavor to uphold.
You have said a couple of things I want to point out. Number one, that you believe education is a lifelong tool, that it pays benefits sometimes years after graduation. And you are also vocally opposed to the Obama administration's proposal to rank and evaluate colleges on how well their graduates do in the workplace after they get out of school. And so my question is, if I'm spending, I don't know, $250,000 to send my 16-year-old to Harvard or Stanford, or even $50,000 for a state school, how can you possibly be opposed to me wanting to know what I'm going to get for my money?
I'm not opposed to a focus on the importance of the kinds of work that students can undertake after they graduate. My criticism of the original Obama administration proposal was that a focus on earnings at first job is a very distorting means of evaluating education. And some of our economists here at Harvard have done analyses of this and find that you really only begin to get an accurate reflection of lifetime earnings if you look at 10 years out. So I think they're looking hard at more nuanced ways of measuring output of education.
You said up at Aspen the other day at the Ideas Festival that you, Harvard, could fill your entering class with valedictorians like twice over. And with an acceptance rate of something less than 6% this year, I don't argue that at all. But I wonder how you react when people basically say, listen, it's just a crapshoot out there. And it's an arbitrary and capricious process when valedictorian A gets in and valedictorian B doesn't.
It's nothing like capricious or arbitrary in that our admission staff and the alumni around the world who interview students spend so much time and energy getting to know every single one of the applicants. But we try very hard to make sure that we choose from the widest array of talent. And we can do this in part because we have a financial aid policy that supports 60% of our undergraduates. And for that 60% of students on financial aid, they pay an average of $12,000 a year. So Harvard is very affordable.
Not to take anything away at all from your admission staff or for all that you do for the affordability, but you appreciate the sentiment, right, that college admissions nowadays, whether it's Harvard or the local community college, are a tricky, tricky thing.
They're tricky.
Yeah.
It's something students should realize is there are a lot of terrific schools, and not to be too heartbroken if one or another doesn't work out.
I'm going to have my 16-year-old call you in about 18 months. All right. Drew Faust is the president of Harvard University. Dr. Faust, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Both Delta Airlines and Boeing report quarterly profits tomorrow. You would naturally expect the giant company that buys planes would have a pretty good relationship with a giant company that makes planes. And the two have indeed been buddies over the years. But at the moment, two of the biggest guns in aviation are lined up on opposite sides of one of Washington's biggest policy fights. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Big companies tend to get their way in Congress because opponents are usually weak. Wall Street versus Main Street, cable companies against subscribers. Those aren't real matches. That's like Mike Tyson fighting your Uncle Stewart. But Boeing versus Delta, that's a fight.
I have about 100 Delta employees here with me that have my back today.
That's Delta CEO Richard Anderson testifying on the Hill, flanked by uniformed pilots and flight attendants.
I'm here to talk about their jobs because the Ex-Im Bank takes their jobs.
Anderson's talking about the Export-Import Bank, and he's angry because Boeing has long gotten what it wants from the bank, which, among other things, uses American tax money to help foreign airlines buy Boeing planes. And those are Delta's competitors. The airline doesn't like the idea of American money going to them.
It puts a face on the usually unseen victims of these government deals.
Veronica DeRugie is senior fellow at the Mercatus Center and thinks of the Ex-Im Bank as corporate welfare in aviation or any industry. When equally powerful companies face off, the outcome's hard to predict. Totally different than when a whole industry goes up against a set of regulations. Tom Tacker is an economics professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
I think it's a big deal, and it does make it more interesting.
It also puts the debate in the public eye. That matters, says UNC political scientist Frank Baumgartner.
And the fights that aren't fair, nobody even knows about them. They're done within the boardrooms or the committee rooms without any fanfare, and the status quo remains what it is.
But with Delta in the ring and skeptics in Congress, Boeing's long and cushy ride with the Ex-Im Bank is hitting unusual turbulence. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, it's better to buy on the app than not on the app.
Ain't that always the way? But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. The Dow Industrial's up 0.3% today, 61 points, closed at 17,113. The NASDAQ climbed 0.7%, 31 points, 44.56. The S&P 500 tipped up 0.5%, 9 points. Finished at 1983. Healthcare stocks got a boost after a federal appeals court ruled that certain subsidies for Obamacare are illegal, and then another one ruled they're okay. That is the kind of certainty companies love. Aetna shot up 1%. Cigna improved 0.9% today. Netflix's strong earnings yesterday were not enough to offset news that its foreign expansion would cut into future profits, and thus the stock gave back nearly 5% today. Things under the golden arch is not so golden. McDonald's reported its third straight quarter of lower same-store sales. Shares dropped 1.3%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Reach out and touch someone, or just friend them. AT&T and Facebook are scheduled to release quarterly earnings. The Senate Small Business and Entrepreneurship Committee holds a hearing on empowering women entrepreneurs. And a hailstone that fell during a thunderstorm in Vivian, South Dakota on July 23, 2010 was discovered to be the largest ever recorded in the U.S. It weighed almost 2 pounds. Duck! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not to get all Schumpeterian on you here, that's after Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, but part of what happens when economies grow is something called creative destruction. New industries are formed and old ones die. There are booms and busts, and growth moves from place to place, and if people are lucky, they can move with it. So today, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore visits the destruction side of that equation, a place where things have changed a whole lot, but people still remember.
In a musty room, an afternoon ray of southern sunshine is making Glenn Hayes glow. Or maybe it's that he's doing something he hasn't done in decades.
That's a good pile of tobacco. The leaf is crinkly.
He's grading tobacco.
B3, you think? That means middle of the stalk.
Hayes was born in 1936. He's one of the last of his generation here in Mullins, South Carolina, population 4,500. He's come to visit the state's tobacco museum here, and his hands parse the dried golden leaves on display. It's been decades since he's done this for a living.
We would get up before day, before I went to school that morning when I was 9, 10 years old, and we would lay tobacco out for our parents to grade that day, and about 80% of our income came from tobacco.
With 41 warehouses, tobacco was once king in Mullins, and Hayes was at different points pauper and prince. His dream as a boy was to become a buyer for a big cigarette company, and he did it. He ended up traveling the South, going from auction to auction, grading and buying tobacco each fall. There's still a recording of one of his old auctions.
If you listen real close, if he calls Reynolds, that's me, and I'm bidding with this hand and with my eyes or with whatever, but I'm moving all the time looking at tobacco, you know.
In the early 80s, at tobacco's height, $120 million would flow through the warehouses of this town and onto farmers and croppers and restaurants. Tobacco marked the calendar, and tobacco marked the social life. Big bands would play in the cavernous warehouses. People lived the crop's ups and downs together, which Hayes says connected them in a way that's rare now.
And I remember a farmer coming to me one time, and he says, I got an awful crop, Glenn, I can't help it. And it wasn't a good crop, but I wouldn't have told him that for nothing in the world. He'd worked just as hard as the next man. Everybody tried to help him if they could. If you could stretch a grade, you did, you know. And we all did that.
Hayes' old friend, Jimmy Daniel, who worked at a warehouse and has now passed away, put it this way in another of the museum's archival recordings.
It was hard work, like anything is. And, of course, the farmer fared good, the warehouse fared good. If he chased the devil, the warehouse caught the devil, too.
That just means it filters down. We all are taking a diminished return here.
That's Reggie McDaniel. He's curator of the museum.
The bids weren't good, and the tobacco was not good, and the farmers didn't get A1 top prices. The warehouse suffered along with the farmers. If the farmer caught the devil, the warehouse caught the devil too.
McDaniel is standing near a 100-year-old barn that was rebuilt inside the museum, and the smell of tobacco hangs thick in the air.
It's got a sweet, earthy smell. My dad used to say it smelled like college.
Why do you say that?
Because it pays for your college.
Tobacco was good to Mullins. But tobacco is also addictive and deadly. It killed 100 million people in the 20th century. And as people began to realize that, smoking declined, government subsidies were withdrawn, tobacco farming also became mechanized and then shifted overseas, along with other industries like textiles. And then it was Mullins that caught the devil. Today, it has the highest unemployment rate in the state.
The jobs eliminated all the textiles and all the companies that left. There are no incentives for people to stay here.
Antonio Williams is hanging out under a pecan tree in a lot full of rubble and weeds. It used to be a small mall before it was torn down. Sometimes people come here for day work. Right now, a few kids are running around and a few old men are sitting on milk crates drinking.
It's not for a young person here. My son is 17 years old and he got a scholarship. He's an A&M honor roll student and I just want him to get him up out of here.
The story of Mullins is a story of lots of small towns in the tobacco belt.
Eldred Prince Jr. is professor of American history at Coastal Carolina University in Conway.
Nobody, no sensible person would lament the loss of tobacco as a substance. It has a lot to answer for in the illness that it has caused. On the other hand, the culture that it inspired and created, there are some valuable things.
To have entire towns working on the same thing, winning or losing together and sharing work.
We'll go over and help you today at your farm, and then tomorrow you can come over and help us. Swapping work, it was called. It built neighborhoods like that.
Of course, plenty of southern towns survived, even thrived, after tobacco. They replaced their tobacco fields with a Boeing plant or an auto manufacturer, or in many cases turned to tourism.
We're very much part of the Sun Belt here. But Mullins is still in the shade.
In front of one of Mullins' last two remaining tobacco warehouses, a downpour has started. The warehouse is an antique mall now. They're good antiques, but they seem small in the immense space. In Mullins, South Carolina, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
What if I told you that there was a product you could make at home for practically nothing, with very little effort, really, and that it would be almost identical to the commercially made version you buy at the store? A product which, by the way, Americans spend nearly $3 billion a year on. Oh, and it's had a huge impact on humankind. So what do you think? Sound good? Market Police's David Weinberg has the big reveal.
In the 1986 film The Mosquito Coast, Harrison Ford plays an eccentric inventor who moves his family to a remote jungle to build an ice factory. He wants to bring ice to people who've never seen it before.
If they saw an ice cube, they'd probably think it was a diamond or a jewel of some kind. Ice is civilization.
The ice trade had a huge impact on civilization. It allowed meat and produce to be shipped and stored safely, but that changed with the advent of refrigeration.
Ice is more of an afterthought item. People just say, hey, it's just, you know, frozen water. Anybody could do it.
John Renaudin is the vice president of Pelican Ice, just outside New Orleans. Pelican claims to be the longest continually running ice house in North America. Most of the ice sold in North America today comes from small operations like his.
It's kind of something between a commodity and a luxury.
Mike Wildberger and his wife own the Kihei Ice Company in Maui. They sell bagged ice to fishing boats and airline catering companies, but mostly they sell to stores.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, any place where you see a bag of ice in the store.
Wildberger's plant can produce 50 tons of ice per day, but increasingly stores are buying their own smaller ice machines, or as Wildberger calls them, disruptive technology.
I was just heading into lunch at a Filipino store, and we're all friends, but, you know, they got an ice maker, so they bag their own ice. They don't buy it from me.
But this is new competition. Wildberger says his business has grown by about 800% since he started 15 years ago. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We're going to start a new series on the program today. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, is the featured attraction for a thing we are going to call Codebreaker. Basically, a way to decode how technology is affecting our lives. First up is a race of sorts to see who can buy concert tickets faster. And so for that, Ben Johnson is on the line. He is,
all right,
of course,
wait, Kai. This what? Isn't how you start a race. Come on.
All right, well,
there's got to be a flag and or a gun shooting or something right, like
okay.
that, right?
Okay, so what am I supposed to do? How's this going
to
work?
All right, so listen, I want you to go to Ticketmaster.com.
Okay.
On your regular old-fashioned computer.
Regular, which I have here in our brand new studios.
And you and I are going to race.
Okay.
I've got my trusty phone in front of
okay.
me. And I'm using the Live Nation app, which,
all
as
right.
you know, is connected to Ticketmaster.
Yes.
Slightly different. But so you and I are going to search for, obviously, our favorite band of all time,
yes,
One Direction.
No, you're going to make
yes.
me do that?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
man. I should tell you you're going to win because on my browser right here it says waiting for Ticketmaster.com. But in the interest
right.
of moving this interview along,
yes.
perhaps you should tell me why we're racing. What's your point here, young man?
So there's been some movement in the app space.
Uh-huh.
And some of these big companies have new apps, and it's better to buy on the app than not on the app. So you and I know this experience of doing it on the computer, right?
Sure.
You sit there, you pick your tickets, you prove you're not a robot by filling out that little CAPTCHA thing with the numbers and stuff.
All right. So buying it online stinks, right? Is that
yeah.
what you're telling me? That I would have been the loser in this thing even if the race had gone right? Is that what you're saying?
That's kind of
right,
what I'm
so
telling you.
So what does the app ecosystem then look like for buying tickets?
Okay, so in some ways, shocker, it looks a lot like the old-fashioned web system for buying tickets, right? You only got a couple serious options for buying them. You have a Ticketmaster app. You also have a Live Nation app. And you know about iBeacon, right? It's that...
Well, it's this
thing in your phone, right,
yeah.
that tells...
Oh, yeah. It tells broadcast. It tells retailers where you are, all that stuff. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And
huh.
there are actually some interesting apps that are using this. And this is a slightly different thing, but they're using this to move people forward in seats. So, you know, you've been to a concert, right, where you're up in the nosebleeds
oh, yeah.
and all the people with the fancy seats just didn't show up because they got something
that's
better
right.
to
and
do.
It's all empty down there, yeah.
Now, if you're part of the One Direction fan club, as
hey
I
now.
Know you
hey
are.
Hey now. Hey ho. Come on.
Then they might actually move you forward. So there are interesting things happening in the app space in that regard.
Right. You should know, by the way, that Ticketmaster.com just came up with internal server error.
Yeah.
So,
well,
you know, you were gonna win hands down. All right. What I hear you saying to me, Ben, though, is that here we are, 2014, you know, the age of digital everything, and I've got two choices, a lame website or a phone app. I mean, what else do we got?
You know, unfortunately, the answer is not a lot.
That's it. Right?
I mean, there are options out there, but you know, as we both know, you're basically going to one place when it comes to buying tickets for regular ticketed large venue, medium sized venue events.
Which is the whole, you know, not quite monopoly, but they've got us. They, the concert promoters and bands, have us, the ticket buying public, over a barrel.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is very true.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, the guy who is helping us break the code on what all this new tech can do for us. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kat.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, against which everything you have ever heard about Congress being off more than it's actually in session and working pales in comparison. This item from the Washington Post. It turns out that Congress working during the month of August is actually against the law. I know. Congress will recess for its summer break next Friday because the Legislative Reorganization Act of 1970 says it has to. The House and Senate shall recess, and here I quote, not later than July 31st of each year to the second day after Labor Day, which reminds me, I need to renegotiate my contract. All right, we are done. That is Marketplace on this, what, Tuesday, I guess. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh, by the way, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.